This is bookcareers.com live, the podcast about careers in book publishing for people who are looking for a job, building a career, or who want to do their current job better. I'm your host, Suzanne Collier, the founder of bookcareers.com, and it's my job to solve career problems relating to the book world. Hello and welcome to episode 175 of bookcareers.com live. Our podcast is currently on a summer break and we're replaying some of our favourite and important interviews, all of which are worth second listen. Today is part two of our interview with Jeremy Trevethan, who has since been promoted to Managing Director of the Adult Division at Pan Macmillan. Please note, this is a replay of an earlier episode and any dates or information may have subsequently changed. Do check our website, bookcareers.com, for the latest news. You've got some really high-profile celebrity authors published both last year and coming up this year.
Yeah.
When working with such high-profile people, how do you initially go about starting that process? What skills would you say are particularly helpful within the process? And how do you keep composure and maintain a professional attitude when working with somebody that perhaps you idolise or admire?
One of the things that we try and do is to get directly to the celebrity at the very beginning of the process. And so the best way to do that is once you've won the auction, is to find a way to get to see them immediately. So with Elton, we won a really complicated auction, which also involved me and my boss flying out to Atlanta to, it was a beauty contest at the end between us and one other publisher. And we had to go and meet Elton and David in their flat in Atlanta. And so that was good because we managed to meet them face to face. And that's one of the really important things to try and do. So once we won the auction, we immediately, I emailed the agent and said, you know, I need to have Elton and David's email, because basically next time they're in the UK, we want to invite them to the building to meet everyone, because that's going to be, and, you know, sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't, but this time it did. And so Elton and David, that was quite a comical day when they came to the office and there was all sorts of security, but they told us that they were going to be, you know, everything had to be incredibly discreet. And so we were waiting for them by the front door of the of our building, and we were expecting like a sort of nondescript, you know, black car. And then at the end of the street, I saw this giant pink Rolls Royce coming down the street. And I remember saying to my boss, my God, so this is what being discreet is for Elton, is a giant pink Rolls Royce, which is really funny. But so the thing is to try and get to see them face to face. And once you've got that, the other thing is to be really diplomatic but tough with the teams that surround them. And you have to sometimes be quite forceful. I mean, we're doing Elton's paperback this autumn, and we've got slightly stuck with his management team at the moment with various things that we need approving right now. And I just sent off a really sort of strong email yesterday, which has unlocked the blockage. And so you have to sort of be diplomatic, but you also have to be really quite firm with them. And you have to remind them that you've invested an awful lot of money, and actually, you know, there are things they need to do, and things like publicity is always a fraught thing. So with publicity, we try and build that in to our offer. So you sort of say that our offer is contingent on Elton being available for 2 weeks in the UK to do any publicity that we have, and then I have to hold them to that. And we structure the payout of the advance so that some of the money that he gets, he only gets after he's done the publicity for us. So in order to not get trapped in a thing where you've paid all the money and you have no leverage to persuade them that they have to do stuff. So it's fun, but it's quite tough. And and I have to say that, so Elton is one of my idols. what happens really quickly is that they become really human very quickly. So you forget everything. The only person I imagine that I might not have been able to deal with at all is David Bowie. I think I would have got completely tongue-tied and unable to speak if we had ever managed to sign him up. But Elton was fine, and actually he was great. He's been lovely. And Mariah Carey is going to be lovely too. She is a massive diva, but it makes you laugh. She's got a sort of sense of humour about herself being it, and you can't help but sort of laugh while she's being incredibly grand. It's an extraordinary book, this book that's coming, because and she's an amazing diva, and it's a fantastic book. That's our big autumn book this year.
Fantastic. And I love the canny thing that you do about holding them to the publicity, holding back some of the advance to the publicity, because so many times I've seen publishers get stung over that.
Absolutely, yeah.
Hide all the money up in the book, and the author is acting, sadly, too much of a diva, refusing to do publicity, exactly. Or turning their nose up at the publicity that's been arranged.
Exactly.
Or, where we've had, I've worked with a very, very high profile author, I won't name them, where they came to the book launch and they, first of all, they'd refused to sign any books at the book launch. Hmm. But secondly, which was okay, we got that, but secondly, they were due to take a minimum of 12 photographs and they turned up. And they said, we're not having any photographs. And it just, yeah. I mean, you talk them round, but had things been slightly different, there'd have been an obligation for them to do that.
Exactly. One of the great things about the world now is that, of course, each of them has a social media team doing the social media, and actually that's a good thing. So you know, if the celebrity is not cooperating much, you can contact the social media team. And of course, they're looking for content the whole time and stuff to do. And so often you can end up putting content out on the star's social media, which is sort of what you want anyway, because you want to get to those fans, you know.
Yeah. It's great. It's really interesting. Now, what do you make of this Super September, where we have a huge set of releases coming up all on one day in one month? Is it really possible for so many new releases to have an impact at once?
Well, the first thing I'm going to say is that we are a very odd market. So the UK, and this has gone on for years now, the UK publishes more titles each year in all of its publishing than the US. So for instance, I think we publish about double the number of new titles in the UK that the US market does, even though the US market is much, much bigger. And for a while, about 15 years ago, for a while this kept on being raised as an issue, and you know publishers would sort of wring their hands and say, we've all got to publish less books. So there is a sort of issue about that anyway, an overarching issue. And the point to make about that, though, then, is that each month, in normal times, we are publishing around 300 to 400 new titles in the UK. So actually, that is quite normal. What is not normal is that, you know, the way that normally works is that the really big commercial titles are sort of, but by the retailers essentially, are spread out across the year so that there's space for them each to, you know, reach their potential. Because of the COVID crisis, the different groups operated in a different way. And so, for instance, I think Hachette decided not to move any titles at all. And so they just kept everything in the publishing months that were set. HarperCollins moved everything off to the autumn or to early next year. We took a decision that we learned very early on that the supermarkets were going to stay open and that they were treating books as an essential product. And so we decided that our big commercial fiction, we would big commercial publishing, we would leave where they were. But anything that was going to be sold through the high street, so through Waterstones or Smith's Travel or the Indies, that was going to be their main route to market, that we had to move them off because they were all, you know, all those outlets were just shut. And while Waterstones.com has massively improved over the shutdown, which is great, it wouldn't have compensated. So I think what's happened is that there's a great crush of those sorts of books coming this autumn. And the problem about those books is that they're the very books that rely more on publicity, particularly publicity, to generate their sales, and less about marketing. So there is an anxiety. I mean, and the problem is, you know, we've all had to do this because of the current circumstances. So there is an anxiety, I think, amongst all publishers about, you know, whether some of the books that they've invested in are going to succeed. But this seems to be, it seems to be the only way through. And I know retailers have complained, but to be honest, retailers, all the scheduling was done in complete collaboration with retailers. So, you know, I feel it's a little bit rich of the retailers to say, oh my God, you know, this is horrendous. When all the publishers talked to them all saying, you know, what do you want to do? How do you want to do this? So, and we had various books that we wanted to move off to next year. And Waterstones or the supermarkets or whoever would, you know, came back and said, no, we want to keep that there. So I suspect there will be some casualties along the way. I think what's going on at the moment is that the market seems to be gravitating back to trusted author brands. So the commercial fiction has taken off, and in fact, we're ahead. In our commercial publishing, we're ahead of the budget that we set before COVID happened. We're well over a million ahead, which is sort of extraordinary, yeah. But in our literary publishing, we're behind because that's the stuff that's driven by high street. And so really, it's going to be down to the quality of your publicity and comms teams, and actually digital comms people. As to how those books will get through. We've had some good stuff already. We've just seen the provisional bestseller list this week, and there's a book that we've got on the Booker long list by a debut author called Douglas Stewart, called Shuggy Bane. And it's been getting fantastic reviews and review coverage, both here and in the US. And just before I came on, I saw that it's got into the hardback bestseller list this week, and that's what we're going to need is, you need to sort of get everything going to drive these books into the bestseller list, which will then give them profile, which will then hopefully keep the sales going. Yeah.
It's all about building momentum there.
Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Well done on the turnover. I think
that's great, isn't it? Yeah. We're so surprised, but
very
delighted.
Very, very positive, I think, particularly for the people here today. Now, I've seen there's currently only one vacancy at the moment at PanMac, and it's in the sales department. Are there any plans to hire roles on your team?
In the editorial teams? Not at the moment, but having said that, I've just announced in this last week. So I told you that structure for the adult division. Yeah. I had a publisher for Bluebird with the wonderful Carol Tomkinson. And I had a new publisher for Picador, a chap called Philip Gwynne Jones, who started in May, I think. And my final piece of the jigsaw was to find a publisher for Pan. And so I've just announced a wonderful lady called Lucy Hale as the new Pan publisher. And what that now means is that I can sit down with these three publishers, work out our strategies for areas of publishing that we may not be strong enough in or that we want to move into, and then work out a business plan for what we do for those things. So what I would say is watch this space. Things are going well at the company, and I think things are going well at most of the other publishing houses. So I know, you know, a lot of the other companies did the furloughing scheme with the government. I know two of them have decided to pay back the money that they took from the government for the furlough, because they actually ended up doing much better than they thought we were going to. We did a pay cut for the senior staff, and actually we've decided to pay them the money back again, because what happened was there was a collapse in March and April, and then May, June and July have been record sales months for us. So it didn't seem fair to, you know, to keep going with the pay cuts when actually the business is going well. And the good thing about that is it means that most publishing houses, I think, are feeling quite bullish, and therefore any plans that they had for expansion or, you know, new roles or what have you, I suspect are coming back into focus.
That's really good news. That's particularly really good news for everybody here. And yeah, I just want to add to that conversation just about Philip Gwynne Jones, just add a little side note for anybody listening, that Philip Gwynne Jones was actually the editor of the SYP magazine imprint back in 1989 when I was first chair. So another little plug in there for the SYP and the great careers that people have after being involved and being on the committee with the SYP. Now, are there any freelance opportunities coming up in various departments? And if so, how does someone go about applying? And what do you look for when appointing freelancers?
So I would say that all publishers are going to be using freelancers more and more. I think it's one of the sort of shifts that's happening. And probably because, you know, there are projects or there are periods of the year where there's more work than it's possible for the team to do. So there will always be scope for freelancing. With us, the way to get onto the sort of register for freelancers that we use. So in terms of editorial stuff, it's probably best to write to me or to the individual publishers of the imprints if you think you work in a particular area that is appropriate for you. You know, what you'll find is that each of us have a sort of roster of freelancers that we keep using. And we have some tests and things that we ask you to do just so that we can get a gauge of, you know, the work that you can do. But there will be we use freelancers in our comms teams. We use freelancers in editorial, we don't so much in sales, I don't think. But we use freelancers in our art department. So there's a lot of freelance opportunity. And actually, I'd say that's not a great way of getting experience. You know, there's nothing that looks good on a CV when you're applying for a job than saying, you know, I've been doing freelance work for Penguin and for Random House and what have you. It's not a good way of creating an aspect of your CV that makes you attractive.
Right. Now, due to the increased number of people working from home during the pandemic, is remote working something that Pam McMillan will be more open to in order to make working in publishing an accessible role for those not living in or near London? Would it be up to the discretion of different departments, or would you think it will be a whole company-wide thing?
I think it's going to be a whole company-wide thing. We've been talking about it already. Anything that happens, you know, of course it's awful that we're in this situation and being locked down, and it's awful, you know, that people are dying as a result of this virus. But this thing that we've been forced to do of working from home, there's been benefits as well as downsides. And some of the benefits are that, for instance, meetings that we have, a lot of us agree that meetings are actually much better online than they are in the room, particularly things like the cover meeting, because, you know, what it means is you can have the cover right in front of you and you can see everything, whereas in a cover meeting there's, you know, maybe 40 people in the room, and often you're peering over people's shoulders to try and get a good look at the thing on the on the table. So there's a lot of things that we have already decided we're going to keep doing once I come up with this line, which I'm quite pleased with. Once Corona is just a beer that you stick a lime in, that we'll keep doing. But one of the things that we've already talked about, we've done a couple of staff surveys to ask people about their attitudes to working from home. And each time we've done the survey, the number of people saying actually they really like working from home, and they think that, you know, they want to be able to come back to the office in order to have that contact with people, but that they're pretty sure that they're going to work, you know, some portion of their time at home. Now, in editorial teams, that's quite normal, but in a lot of the other departments, it's not normal. But so we've already decided to say to everyone, you know, as a company, we're going to move to a hybrid model, probably, where we accept that people will be working from home some days and in the office some days, and there shouldn't be any problem about it. So the problem used to be that, you know, if we have these key meetings, you had to be in the building for those key meetings to be able to attend. But what we've now learned is you don't need to be in the building to attend the meeting. So actually it becomes much more flexible. And it, you know, as I said right at the beginning, one of the things about Pam McMillan is this sort of collaborative atmosphere and everything. And I think this is one of the things that, you know, we have to do, because it's part of the DNA of the company, is to sort of accept that this is how people want to work now. And what it then does is it opens, and we've already talked about this too, it then does open up the way to say, well, you don't need to be based in London. We've already had our first request from someone already working with us they want to relocate to Devon. And we've gone back and said, well, that's fine, actually. And just so long as you can come up, you know, maybe two or three times a month to see people and have, you know, face-to-face meetings with people, just so that we don't lose touch with you entirely physically, that's fine. And so the corollary to that will be, you know, people who are not based in London but want to come and work for the company, we're going to be open to that.
That's fantastic, and that's a great note to end on. Jeremy, thank you so much for your
time.
It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. I really want to thank Jeremy for being so helpful and encouraging. Remember, if you're unemployed and have lost your book industry job, then you can join us too. And we've got an entry-level job club starting in a few weeks for all others. Details are on the bookcareers.com website. And if there's anything else, my email, as always, is suzanne@bookcareers.com. And if you like this podcast, please will you rate us on iTunes so that others can find us too. Now it is your opportunity to join in the live discussion. You can find us across social media using the hashtag BookCareers, or on Twitter @BookCareers, or me personally, Suzanne Collier. Or visit our own platform at bookcareers.com/live. Thank you for listening. May you all be doing a job you love and being paid the salary that you so richly deserve.